Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did René Descartes influence Western thinking during his life? And how do events after his death illustrate modern ideas about the apparent contradictions between scientific facts and religious truths? Writer Russell Shorto found a fascinating intersection between reason and faith as he researched this stranger-than-fiction story of what became of the physical remains of the 17th-century philosopher René Descartes after his death in Sweden at the age of 53. For 16 years, Descartes lay buried in peace, if not in a stately grave, until he was quietly brought back to France, allowing his most ardent admirers to equate his remains with saintly relics. Russell Shorter's latest book is called Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason, and it's just been released in paperback. Russell, welcome to Think. We should start with this. The man at the center of this conflict between faith and reason was, in fact, a devout Catholic.
Oh, that's right. And, you know, there's so many ironies in that goes back to the stories that play out over the past 350 years of the modern world. But, you know, Descartes has been credited or blamed with creating the philosophical underpinnings of modernity, the modern world, secularism. And there's, you know, there's some truth to that. But if you start with that fact that he himself was a devout Catholic, then that begins to put it in a different perspective.
Yeah. Before, I guess, scientific thinking really took hold as a way of understanding the world, it was a really mysterious and magical place, but in many ways a very uncertain and frightening world.
The world was, yes. And one interesting thing about that generation in which he grew up, which is, you might say, the first modern generation, is that they struggled to deal with that. And someone like Descartes is interesting because, especially if you read his letters and things, he is someone who created philosophically this new mental infrastructure that allowed you to look at a world, you might say, from secular eyes. But at the same time, a lot of his biographers have said he was essentially a medieval thinker, and I guess that's true because he himself stayed, I think, within a theological worldview. And I think all his life struggled to figure out how to make sense of this other way of seeing things that he created.
And one of the things he did was sort of separate the idea of mind and body.
Yeah, and that is really the kind of, if you can distill what his wider role was, that's the way to do it, because what he did was this was not just him. People at that time, because you had that whole generation of people like Descartes and Galileo and Francis Bacon and William Harvey, who were looking into the natural world and deciding that there was truth to be discovered there. And when you did that, you were putting emphasis on the material world that, particularly in the theological worldview of Catholicism, that was a scary thing because you were then rooting everything in the physical and maybe not in what they would at that time would have called mind-soul. In other words, the mental and including the spiritual were on a certain plane. And you know, a lot of this, the reason this is worth talking about is a lot of this we still think, either you know, sort of in the back of our mind or in the front of our mind, we still think of the mind and the soul as being these things that are not part of the physical world. So this is Descartes' legacy.
Yeah, can you talk about what he believed might come of his attempts to understand what could be known as empirical fact as opposed to what was within the realm of the spiritual?
Yeah, I mean, one of the nice things, once I hit on this idea of creating kind of an intellectual detective story of what happened to his remains, and so the focus is on his remains, is that it's a nice metaphor, a nice way to talk about this very split between mind and body, because you're looking at the body of the ultimate thinker, in a way. And he himself, an interesting thing about him is that he's, in history, he's gone down as this person who is, as I say, the ultimate thinker. His very name, Descartes, is associated with abstraction, you know, Cartesian coordinates and Cartesian dualism things. But he himself was very focused on the physical. He was, along like Galileo, he was a scientist of his day. He studied salt crystals and how the eye worked and how the heart worked. He dissected corpses. And in particular, what's interesting, and to sort of redouble this irony, is that Descartes was particularly interested in the human body. He saw himself for a large part of his career as basically a doctor, or rather as a medical explorer. And he, at the time, people like him, they were so excited, so enthusiastic about this new approach that they saw the physical world, in particular the body, as kind of something that, like a machine, and if you found the key and turned the key, or found the switch and flipped the switch, you could end disease and extend human life almost infinitely. And that was, for a long time, what he saw to be his main goal. And not just him, but as he became revered throughout Europe and also reviled, other people started looking to him as the one who was going to extend life, almost infinitely, so much so that when he finally died, several people couldn't believe it, and they wrote letters back and forth to each other basically saying, wait a second, he was going to tell us how to live forever, and he died, you know.
And he had grown up sort of a sickly kid.
Yeah, so that played, you're speculating here, but you have to think that played a part in it. And he grew up sickly, and, in that day, people could be very cold about things, and the physicians just told his parents in front of him, look, he's not going to make it to adulthood, that kind of thing. And then when he went away to college, which he did, I think, about the age of 12, he started to improve. But this health issue was always uppermost in his mind. And then whenever he turned about 40 and his hair started to go gray, he started to work on cures to end graying. So he was very modern in a number of ways.
One thing that happened when he finished his education was that the first thing he did was to go travel for 8 or 9 years, I guess. Can you talk about how that time and what he was doing then influenced his thinking?
Yeah, he did that, and he studied at a Jesuit college called La Flèche in France, which still exists, and it was considered the best European education you could get. And by the time he finished, he was very dissatisfied, and because, of course, what he had been taught was scholastic learning. That was the learning that had been built up over the Middle Ages, and that was a blend of biblical teaching and Aristotelianism and ideas from Aristotle and other great Greek thinkers. And he came to feel that it was, hogwash is a modern term, but he just thought that it lacked foundation. And so he decided he would go off in the world, and he wrote this down as his, great adventure. Like many people at that age, you finish high school, you finish college, and you decide you're going to go see the world, and you're going to get a different handle on knowledge. And that was the first, that was the basis of it. And he may have even had a kind of psychological break or breakdown then, which is also not uncommon among people at that age. And that culminates with him deciding, giving himself this famous test, where he would test all of the knowledge that he had learned, and sound these principles out one by one. And if they didn't seem, as he said, clear and distinct, he would set each of these aside until he came to something that seemed clear and distinct to him. And this is how you get to the famous Cartesian, I think, therefore I am, because each of these things that he had been taught at the most famous educational establishment in the country, he sounded out, and he said he decided it wasn't sound, and he set it aside. And in his writings, he very carefully said, basically, this is only a test, because some of these principles were things like the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. I mean, if he had said, I'm really deciding this is not intellectually sound, then he would have been in trouble. So what he did was say, I'm just testing to see what happens here. And each of these principles he tests, finds that it's not sound, not satisfying, and sets it aside until, famously, he comes to one thing, which is the fact that he is thinking these thoughts. You can't logically dispute that. So however flimsy it is, that then, he decided, would be the basis on which he would build a new approach to knowledge. I think, therefore I am, therefore I must exist, this thinker must exist. Therefore, the human mind that is doing this thinking, is going to be the basis for this new orientation.
Which in so many ways really elevates the mind, especially in sort of explaining the idea that we can't necessarily trust our senses.
Yeah, we can't trust our senses, but he also knew very well that you can't necessarily trust your mind. Your mind plays tricks on you all the time. So that's why I say, however flimsy, because he was well aware that this was not perfect and it was not bedrock, as opposed to the kind of thinking that had preceded him, the kind of system. Because if you decide that received wisdom from the church is bedrock and is indisputable, then you have bedrock. You have certainty. And so this then begins another of those tracks of the modern world, the advent of the age of uncertainty, when you have to reason and then make mistakes, and you have to you backtrack and you work with probability and things and statistics, which gets you closer and closer to something, but you never get absolute truth.
Russell, how closely was the Catholic Church following his work?
Very closely. In fact, it's not a case of, he and the other scientists of the day were doing what they were doing, and the church was opposed to it. In fact, many of his most ardent followers were themselves Catholic priests. Because the church was, for one thing, the church was not one thing. It was not a monolith. Different divisions within the church were more disposed toward modern thinking, scientific thinking. And he himself, as we began by saying, was a very devout Catholic, and he corresponded with a lot of priests. Nevertheless, he did get into trouble with them. So there was always this dance, he himself, clearly in his writings, he is tailoring what he's saying at times so as not to get in trouble with the church. And very clearly, when Galileo was censured by the Vatican, Descartes was about to publish a book, and he pulled it back and said, never mind, this is too hot, I'm not going to go there. So he was in terms of personality, he was very curious because he was very bold, very arrogant. He actually thought he was going to create a new framework for human thought, which, is a pretty bold thing to think about yourself. On the other hand, he was very timid about the church and its censure, and about things like, he was very careful to foster royal friends and things like that. So he had this combination of braggadocio and also timidity.
Russell Shorto is my guest. His book is called Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Russell Shorto. His book is called Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. I guess we should pause here, Russell, to remind people that in the 17th century, calling someone an atheist didn't necessarily mean this person rejected belief in God. It was a label applied to people who rejected mediation by the church.
Yeah, it was an extreme thing, extreme epithet, and the church was, of course, so all-encompassing, and its value system, its structure, was tied to everything, practically. And so atheist was a charge that meant, yeah, I mean, not believing in God was almost outside of people's reckoning. But if you were against these principles, you could be called an atheist, too.
So he had spent most of his adult life not in France, where he was born, but in Holland. But then he was sort of summoned to Sweden, where he was not keen to go. Can you talk about what happened there?
Yeah, he had first, after he published the Discourse on the Method, which is what I was describing before, in which he talked about his new method for underpinning knowledge, new approach to knowledge. He very quickly became famous throughout Europe, and he both loved and hated this. If he wanted to change the world, and in order to do that, you had to have people know about you. On the other hand, he wanted to be away from people so that he could think. So he moved around a lot. He spent most of his career in the Low Countries, in Holland, because it was a relatively liberal, as it still is, a liberal place for thinking, for publishing. But there, even there, he was being attacked, as you say, having atheistic ideas and ideas that challenged the order of things. And some of the attacks are quite interesting, too, because they have a very modern ring to it. He was being attacked for being, because he was saying, you know, look, everything that you've learned, tear that away, and here's a new system. They interpreted that as, forget everything you've learned, just listen to me. And so they tried to portray him as being kind of a cult figure who wanted to sort of lead young people to follow him down the path. So he reached a point where this was really wearing him down, and he received an invitation from Queen Christina of Sweden, who was a young monarch, very interested in new thinking and new ideas. Sweden was up and coming. It had been, you know, considered a backwater compared to other parts of Europe, but it was up and coming, and she wanted to have a royal court, as Louis XIV had, for example, and so she wanted Descartes to be her court philosopher, and he accepted the invitation because his friend, whose name was Chanu, was the French ambassador there, and Chanu said, you know, come and it'll be great, and you'll be treated well. So he, even though he didn't like the cold, but he went to Sweden anyway. And the other thing that he hated, which when I studied philosophy as an undergraduate endeared me to Descartes, was he hated getting up in the morning. And normally he would get up at about 11.
And she wanted him there at 5 in the morning.
She wanted him teaching her philosophy at 5 in the morning. So he's, you know, trudging through across the old town of Stockholm at 5 in the morning in the winter cold. Within a few weeks, he catches pneumonia and dies. So it all comes to an end rather suddenly. At least his life comes to an end, which brings you then to the beginning of another story, of course, which is the story of his remains.
Yeah, it's sort of at the heart of your book, and I'm sorry that it's taken this long to get there, but I felt we needed to sort of lay the groundwork.
Yeah, of course.
Burying him presented quite a problem for Queen Christina.
Yeah, she had the idea to bury him in state in the place which was the hall of her ancestors, but the French ambassador said, look, he's a Catholic, and we have to bury him in a Catholic place. And I think part of the difficulty, too, was that Chanu, the ambassador, felt very uncomfortable about the whole turn of events because he himself had invited, Descartes was this internationally known figure, Chanu had invited him to Sweden, and he died. So he felt kind of responsible. And so he just kind of quickly sent a series of letters around to important people in Europe saying, oh, you know, our beloved Descartes has died. So sorry. And he had him buried in a ceremony that was on the outskirts of town. I mean, buried in a cemetery, in a graveyard on the outskirts of town. And, basically hoped that that would be the end of it.
16 years later, the French ambassador said, let's bring him back.
Yeah, the what happened in that 16 years, he died in 1650, and by 1666, his followers had continued to proliferate in Europe, in universities and in power centers, and they were these ideas, which we would call the early state, we would call this like the beta version of science, science as a, sort of science in its primitive form. And again, at the time, this was seen as, had features of maybe it was a cult. People were intrigued by it, but they were afraid of it. Governments and the church, the kings and popes were intrigued. They thought it was a sense that there was the possibility of using this for their ends as a tool, but they were also afraid of it because it seemed to undermine things. So his followers were trying to win legitimacy for Cartesianism, as they called it at the time. And they hit on the idea to use the remains of the master to help them. So his followers, the group of them in Paris, requested and they got permission to have the bones exhumed. And there is now a new ambassador in Stockholm. And he asked the permission from the Swedish government, and they gave it, and he had the bones dug up, and then he oversaw this translation, as they call them, using the Catholic term for movement of a saint's bones, the translation of the bones across Northern Europe from Stockholm to Paris.
And the first one to go missing was Descartes' right index finger.
The right index finger, the ambassador, whose name was Turlon, was an interesting figure because he knew who Descartes was, and he was presumably a man of the world who understood these matters. And yet he asked permission of the church to be allowed to take a right index finger bone, as a kind of relic, as a kind of religious relic. And what's interesting about that request is what he's doing is seeing Descartes' work as important and revolutionary, but looking at it through a religious prism and saying, because it was kind of like at that time, any inquiry into the heart of nature was, of course, seen as a spiritual inquiry. And therefore, it was natural to treat Descartes, in a sense, as kind of a saint. And in fact, after he died, there were people around Europe that held seances to summon his spirit and things like this. So that it was, this is what is interesting about this that time, and in a way it continues throughout the whole history of modernity, this confusion over these, how you apply these two templates of the rational, the scientific, and the spiritual. So, yes, the first bone that goes missing is taken as a religious relic.
And can you explain for just a moment the significance of relics? These were sort of the ultimate good luck charm, and every church needed a relic from a confirmed saint.
That's right. Starting back in the early Middle Ages, it was decided that an actual physical relic from a saint would become kind of the seed of a new church, and churches would grow up around this holy object. And this, of course, resulted in the proliferation of relics and fake relics throughout the Middle Ages. And all across the map of Europe in the Middle Ages, then, you had these translation routes and these pilgrimage routes of and seeing, processions and the wagon that the relic would be in. They had certain kinds of wagons, certain kinds of draping and things, and people would know that was a relic. And so it must have been a pretty common sight to see, these trains of relics traipsing around Europe.
And in fact, they were often bought and sold.
Yeah, of course. And then that resulted in the Catholic Church stamping this out. And by Descartes' time, this had been gone out of favor as a kind of a black market. But it was still very much, objects, artifacts, religious relics were still very much revered.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Russell Shorto, whose book is called Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. Let's go on the phones now to Thomas in Dallas. Hello, Thomas.
Hi. If I recall, Leibniz and Descartes sort of simultaneously come up with calculus.
Yeah.
And I understand it was sort of a question as to whether they had collaborated or how much they had interacted. And I was wondering if you were able to unearth any information on that, and if you had any influence out of Andalus and the, you know, coming from that school.
Yeah, on the latter question, I think, yes, there was certainly influence from there. Descartes and Leibniz communicated, and I think, there are people who are better able to answer that question, but I don't think it's ever been ascertained, you know, to what extent their communication resulted in, you know, how it affected each of their ideas.
Will you talk for just a minute about his influence in mathematics? We've talked about him a lot as a philosopher, but in fact, he was very influential in sort of combining geometry and algebra.
Yeah, I mean, what he did was develop a system for depicting mathematical concepts in physical space and reverse, taking geometric notions and using them, finding a method for using them and working with them in mathematics. That's analytic geometry, which is a precursor to calculus.
And we have an email here from Ed who asks, would you speak about the Argyle loom and other such engineering innovations that arose from Descartes' investigations and discourses? As much as these things changed industry and consequently society at large, was there a corollary intellectual enlightenment within commercial society that followed being simply given an amazing and revolutionary technology through his philosophically driven vocation?
Let me answer that this way. One interesting... You know, when you work with a subject as potentially broad as this, you can, you know, it easily gets out of hand. But one interesting way to kind of corral it in large streams is to look at, I mean, Descartes was kind of the progenitor of French science, the French approach to science. And French thinking then as now, I mean, not very many months ago, Sarkozy was complaining about this French kind of tendency to intellectualize and sort of top-down thinking. And that was the case then, and a lot of people have, ascribed this to Descartes, and I think it's largely true. And so that the French school was very good at grand concepts. The British Enlightenment became famous for transforming that into practical uses. You know, the British Enlightenment was all about, new kinds of porcelain and new kinds of pottery and coatings and chemical formulas that could be used and applied to real world products. So the British became sort of tinkerers, which really fueled the Industrial Revolution. And the French then lamented, and they in fact pointed to Descartes saying, he's actually retarded us because he kept things in this high intellectual plane. I mean, you could say that about him, but you could just say that in general about that whole school that kept it at a theoretical, whereas other people became very practical with it.
So going back to the question of his bones, he was taken out of Sweden, not exactly under wraps, but he wasn't even in a regular coffin when his bones were removed.
They were actually afraid that because he was well-known and because of this relic issue, they were afraid that he would be stolen. His remains would be stolen, and so they took the bones were in pieces by this time, and they took him apart and put him in a box that was about 2.5 feet long, and they thought that would be good for disguising it.
Because it could have been anything in the box.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and that made it really easy to not know exactly what was in there.
Yeah, and so the box then winds its way to Paris, and once it gets there, I was talking before about the followers of Descartes who wanted to use these for their purposes. So once it arrives, they use this in a very calculated political way. They have a parade across Paris that emulated all the features of a Catholic parade of relics. And people came out, lined the streets for it, and the parade wound up at the Church of Saint-Geneviève. Geneviève was the patron saint of Paris, at the highest point in Paris. And that's where they would bury him. And there was a ceremony held, and then they held a series of banquets around Paris to which they invited important figures in church and in the government. all using, and this is, again, is a very modern kind of thing, to use this and use the body of the master to win legitimacy for their cause, to say, you know, in effect, this thing called Cartesianism or science, as it would later become, is not to be something to be feared. It's something that we have to work into our system.
And how effective was that with sort of the masses? Essentially, they just they took the portion of him that was the saint and in many cases sort of held on to that.
If what you mean is that people continued to revere him in that way,
yeah.
I'd say over the course of a few decades, that pretty much died out. And his, you know, one of the things I thought was, to me, intriguing, just, you know, when I write narrative history, and I... when I hit up, I originally came on this story. It was literally a footnote in a book of, you know, when I was reading a biography of Descartes, the fact that 16 years after he died, they dug him up and people started taking pieces. And this just pleased me, this thought, for some reason. But as I dug into it, so to speak, I started to see why this intrigued me and why I wanted to focus on this, because it was a really nice metaphor for talking about these things, what you're getting at there, the notion of, you know, the overlap of treating this physical remains of this great thinker, on the one hand in religious context, and on the other hand in a scientific context.
Russell Shorto is my guest. His book is called Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. We'll be back to our discussion in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Russell Shorto. His new book is called Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Russell, how long did it take for people to realize that his skull was missing?
Quite a while. And just in terms of structure, the way I structured the book, we follow his remains, and there are several episodes. One of which I had just outlined in 1660s, when his followers use them in Paris, and then the next time that the remains come back into the world, so to speak, is during the French Revolution, so about a century later. And of course, in that time, all of these seeds that Descartes and his generation planted have grown into science, the scientific, the industrial era. All of this is churning and moving forward, including in the political realm. That is to say, when Descartes said he wanted to base knowledge on the mind and its good sense, that gave this new importance to the individual. And that very quickly led to people starting to talk about women's rights. I mean, in the 1650s, people were talking about women's rights, and if, you know, men have a right to education, why don't women, things like that. And of course, then to just politics generally, to the idea of a nation in which individuals have the say in their government rather than in a divine right of kings.
So democracy.
Yeah, democracy. So the American Revolution, of course, is one manifestation of that, and the French Revolution another. So during the French Revolution, the revolutionary government holds a debate, a fascinating debate about Descartes, because the church in which he was buried in Paris several decades earlier was already falling into decay, and they built a new one, a grand temple. By the time of the French Revolution, it was ready. But the revolutionary government, because the French Revolution, as opposed to the American Revolution, was a real thoroughgoing revolution against the monarchy and also against the church. And so with the French Revolution came this destruction of churches and religious architecture and so on. And so the revolutionary government took control of this new building, which coincidentally was going to be the new home of Descartes and St. Geneviève and others. And they decided to make it into the Pantheon, what is now the Pantheon, this secular temple of relics, you might say, which would be relics of great French heroes. And then they hold a series of debates about whose remains have the right to go in there, and they debate at great length Descartes' contribution. And they are, and it's fascinating to read this in the journals, in the records, because here are these people in the midst of making this world history, the French Revolution, in effect stopping history and having a debate on this whole train of events, starting in the early 1600s and, you know, having, like every generation, they thought they were the, you know, the high point of history. Everything was moving toward them. And looking at Descartes' role in that. So they, you know, it's a long story, which I go into, has a lot of twists and turns, but they basically vote Descartes in. Then the Reign of Terror happens, and a lot of these people who just voted him in start losing their heads, and he's forgotten about. And his body then remains in a garden on the banks of the river until about 1820. 1820, the French Academy of Sciences was the most important, had become the most important scientific body in the world. And they were the ones who, again, because the French, I was talking before about the French being the great kind of abstract thinkers and systematizers, and the French Academy of Science is responsible for a lot of the structure of knowledge today. University departments, the idea that we will have, you know, physics will be a department, and then astronomy will be a sub-department of that, things like that. So that's what they were on about, and they held meetings, the members of the Academy, and at one meeting it was brought to their attention that the remains of Descartes had been for decades sitting in a garden somewhere just moldering, and they decided something had to be done about this. He's the great, he's their intellectual father. So they send a little committee of scientists there, and they open this sarcophagus, actually, up, and they find these, you know, remains, and they discover that there's no skull. So of course, they couldn't figure out what to do about that. They just let it rest. But it happened that there was a Swedish chemist who had been visiting them at the time. 2 years later, he's back home in Stockholm. He opens up a newspaper, and he sees that someone, actually a scientist who had been his mentor, dies, and his estate was auctioned off, and included among the items was the skull of Descartes. So now the story winds all the way back to the 1660s and the first disinterral of Descartes' remains. Now, Berzelius, this scientist, writes to the French Academy and says to them, basically, guess what I found? You know, and he actually goes and tracks down the person who bought it at auction, which, you know, there are so many bizarre little twists and turns here. Was the man who bought it was the owner of a casino who apparently wanted to use the skull of Descartes to decorate his casino. So he buys it from him, sends it to the French Academy, and there's this, to me, wonderful scene where all of these great, you know, the leading scientific thinkers of the world are gathered in this room looking at this object, the skull of Descartes, and, you know, revering it because he's their intellectual forefather. And then it occurs to them to ask a very modern question. How do we know it's real? How do we know it's authentic? And so then they begin their own investigation of this skull. And then there was another investigation later, and then I did mine on top of those in working on the book and sort of uncovered the trail of events. But basically what happened was in 1666 in Stockholm, the remains were disinterred, and a guard was put on them because it was feared that they would be stolen. And the captain of the guard took the skull of Descartes. He stole it. And he actually put his name on it, and then the skull exists today in the Musée de l'Homme, in the Science Museum in Paris, and it is decorated now with the signatures of a number of these Swedes who owned the skull from the 1660s to about 1820.
It seems such a strange thing to write all over this thing.
Yeah, and there was there's a poem in Latin across the forehead. The skull itself is a genuine artifact of this passage of time, you know, that you would call the modern centuries.
Can you talk about what it was like for you when you went down into sort of the basement of this museum and took a look at this thing for yourself?
Yeah, well, it's always, you know, when you're a writer and you come up with some very odd idea, and I guess I tend to come up with odd ideas, and then you decide, no, I'm going to focus on this, and you start with books, and then you move to phone calls and emails and things like that, and then eventually you get to the point where, okay, now I'm going to go to Paris, and the man who is the curator at the museum was very helpful to me, and he invited me there, and so I spent time in his office, and then we go down to the basement in the storage area, and he unlocks this door and takes out this box, this little smooth box that they had especially built for it, opens it up, and there's this gauzy paper, and then he pulls this object out, and finally you see this thing that is, you know, I mean, when you write a book like this, you spend some years of your life on it. And, you know, there it is. And here's this thing that I've, in a way, been pursuing all this time. And at the same time, this is the brain that once thought, I think, therefore I am. I mean, this is the skull that held the brain that once thought that. And, you know, you have to marvel at something like that. I mean, relics, there are relics and then there are relics.
And what's especially delicious is that this person who sort of pioneered the idea of the mind and the body being separate things, is his skull remains separate eternally from his bones.
This, again, you know, once I hit on this story and just thought that this was an interesting, worthwhile metaphor for talking about a lot of other things, then all of these ironies that come to the fore, which, as you say, it's so delicious that his skull early on gets separated from the rest of the remains, and there are a lot of other little things that happen, but the remains supposedly then are buried finally in the Church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés in Paris, and the skull, meanwhile, nowadays, is in this anthropology museum on the other side of the river. So the man, as you say, who's credited with the mind-body problem, has this literal post-mortem mind-body problem where the skull is separated from the body.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Patrick in Richardson. Hello, Patrick.
Hello. I just want to say I can't wait, Mr. Shorter, to buy your book. Very enthralling. And, Chris, once again, great show. You know, it's funny what you were talking about, signing the skull. They said with Descartes defined an idea as that which fills the mind when we conceive a thing. And if you just write your name on a skull, it's interesting to see how you just come into reality a little bit like that. Maybe that has something to do with it. I wanted to see, Mr. Shorto, if you could speak to Descartes' practice, whether he did or not, alchemy. And then also, Sir Francis Bacon and him are linked as being the founders, so to speak, in at least some way, of modern science and systems. Do you think that there's any credence to the old legend that Sir Francis Bacon might actually be William Shakespeare, and did they know each other? Did they collude at all, or did they know about one another? Thank you. I'll take my question off.
Yeah, well, thank you for your kind thoughts. Whether Francis, I don't have any special knowledge on the Francis Bacon. Was he Shakespeare, or responsible for some of Shakespeare's work? But I've just read, because I find that an interesting topic, and read about that. And I don't, from what I understand, I don't think there's much to that theory. Descartes was certainly familiar with Francis Bacon's work, and, you know, Bacon, I mean, there's a continuum over the course of, it's sort of a generation and a half from Bacon, Galileo, Descartes, and Harvey, then Leibniz and Spinoza, and those people, I mean, you see this, I mean, one thing that's interesting is Bacon was someone, maybe this gets to the English-French divide again, Bacon is someone who was really an experimenter and a tinkerer. And Descartes then is much more a thinker. So, I mean, it is, the rap on Descartes is partly true, I think, that he's more a medieval thinker in many ways than some of his contemporaries, than Galileo, for example.
We have an email here from Jack who asks, can you discuss Descartes' influence on the inclusion of self-evident truths in the Declaration of Independence?
Boy, that's a tough one. I haven't heard that. I'll say this, though. Self-evident is another way of talking about clear and distinct ideas. And by the time of self-evident, that is to say, by the time of the founders of the Republic, you had kind of enshrined this notion that of the mind and its capacity to settle on concepts that were clearly and distinctly held to be true. And that stems from Descartes. I don't know that any of them referred to Descartes in, and Descartes is, you know, in many ways, that points to a lot of ways in which, I mean, Descartes isn't often thought of as, you know, the founder of science, say, because he's really at kind of the foundation level. And, you know, when you walk into a building, you don't think about the foundation down there underground. I mean, that's, you know, from the 1620s and 30s to Isaac Newton's time a generation later to what would happen in the 1700s, I mean, each of these layers kind of is built on the other. So I think there is a definite train from clear and distinct ideas to self-evident, but it's not one step.
Russell, is there any movement to get Descartes' skull actually buried again with his bones, or will it remain indefinitely in the museum?
Yeah, two things I'll say. One is that while I, you know, when you do a focus on a topic like this, you encounter a lot of strange characters, and one of which was someone who actually helped me a lot. It was a very nice man who's a retired French medical doctor who has, this is his kind of retirement project, to have the skull DNA tested, have the bones dug up and DNA tested, and he sent me all of his correspondence with the Paris Police Department, and they're basically telling him, go away, we don't want to, you know, jackhammer up this church, because they don't even know where in the church the bones supposedly are. And the second thing is, after my book came out, the hardcover, about a month later, the College of La Flèche in France had this appeal that the skull be returned to them, and it would be enshrined there. And what's ironic about that is, you know, his whole system was built up basically against the things he'd learned there. So it would be kind of a pleasant irony if that's where he ended up.
Russell Shorter's latest book has just been released in paperback. It is called Descartes' Bones, The Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. Russell, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you very much, Chris. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.